so, I've been getting more and more comments and questions that seem to assume I support the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I've never said anything to suggest that. I obviously don't support the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And quite frankly, I would love for people to knock it off because it's just a waste of time. I don't support the Russian invasion of Ukraine, so I don't know why you would come to me and tell me that I do. If you have a comment that you'd like to see featured, you can email info@davidpakman.com. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Become a member. Really, there's no better time. April, beautiful month to do it. Sign up at joinpakman.com. You'll get access to the bonus show. You'll get the daily show 6 hours before everybody else.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
RCT, in sound, from way out.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast.
To get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We were not just let out. And when the shells started landing in Azovstal, I thought my heart would stop and I would not survive it.
Ukrainian civilians evacuate from the besieged steel plant in Mariupol, but hundreds more remain trapped. There's no end in sight to the war. As U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visits Ukraine over the weekend, we'll get an update from Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, just back from Ukraine, where he also visited Bucha, the site of a mass grave of murdered Ukrainian civilians. But first, record scorching heat hits India and Pakistan with a full week of temperatures over 104 degrees Fahrenheit in New Delhi.
The summer that arrived in May and June last year has arrived now in April and the 1st of May. It is extremely hot.
We'll speak with Chandni Singh, senior researcher on climate change adaptation at the Indian Institute for Human Settlements, a lead author at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We'll speak with the scientist who helped lead a new study that finds one in five reptiles face extinction.
We quantified how much evolutionary history of reptiles we stand to lose, 15 billion years. I mean, that's a long time. That's like, almost four times the age of the Earth.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi became the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Ukraine over the weekend. Her surprise trip came just days after President Biden asked Congress for an additional $33 billion for Ukraine. During a meeting with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Pelosi vowed the United States would keep backing Ukraine militarily, quote, until the fight is done.
We believe that we are visiting you to say thank you for your fight for freedom, that we are on a frontier of freedom, and that your fight is a fight for everyone. And so our commitment is to be there for you until the fight is done.
On Friday, the Pentagon confirmed U.S. troops are now training Ukrainian soldiers in Germany on the use of advanced weapons. Over the weekend, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said the U.S. and NATO should stop arming Ukraine if they're, quote, really interested in resolving the Ukraine crisis, unquote. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian government says about 100 civilians have been able to evacuate the besieged Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol after the United Nations helped establish what it described as a safe passage operation. One evacuee said she's been staying inside a basement in the steel plant for 2 months after her home was destroyed.
We lived in the basement starting from the 27th of February. We didn't leave the basement because our house is in close proximity to Azovstal. The whole time we were shelled with mines and then airstrikes started. Our house is completely destroyed. We have a two-story building. It's not there anymore. It burned to the ground.
Hundreds more civilians and many fighters remain trapped at the steel plant in Mariupol, but Russia has reportedly resumed shelling the plant. This comes as the United Nations says the number of Ukrainians who fled the country has now topped 5.5 million. In other developments, a Russian rocket attack has destroyed an airfield in southern Ukraine. Meanwhile, a large fire broke out at a Russian military facility Sunday in the southern Belgorod region, which borders Ukraine. It's the latest incident suggesting Ukraine's carrying out attacks inside Russia. In other news from Ukraine, the Associated Press is reporting Ukrainian authorities have arrested hundreds of people accused of collaborating with the Russians. Ukraine is currently under martial law, which gives authorities the power to detain anyone without a court order for 30 days. The AP reports nearly 400 people have been detained in the Kharkiv region alone. Dozens of pro-Russian activists have also been detained in Kyiv. Republican Congressmember Adam Kinzinger has introduced a joint resolution to give President Biden congressional authority to send U.S. troops to fight in Ukraine if Russia deploys chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons. Kinzinger unveiled his plan during an interview on CBS's Face the Nation.
I don't think we need to be using force in Ukraine right now. I just introduced an AUMF, an authorization for the use of military force, giving the president basically congressional leverage or permission to use it if WMDs, nuclear, biological, or chemical, are used in Ukraine.
A Ukrainian journalist died Thursday in Kyiv in a Russian missile strike on the apartment building where she lived. The journalist, Vera Hirich, worked for the U.S.-funded outlet Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. According to Ukrainian authorities, she is the 23rd known member of the media to be killed since Russia launched its invasion. Meanwhile, a former U.S. Marine has died while fighting alongside Ukrainian forces. Willie Joseph Kansel died last Monday. His mother said he was working for a private military contractor. The name of the company's not been released. European Union energy ministers are holding emergency talks today about a proposal to ban the import of Russian oil by the end of the year. Hungary's threatened to veto the measure. This comes as big oil is reporting significant profits as the war in Ukraine disrupts global energy markets. Over the first 3 months of the year, Chevron reported $6.3 billion in profits. ExxonMobil reported $5.5 billion in profits. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has criticized how fossil fuel companies are responding to the war. In a tweet, he wrote, quote, "Fossil fuel interests are now cynically using the war in Ukraine to try to lock in a high carbon future. A shift to renewables is crucial to mending our broken global energy mix and offering hope to millions suffering climate impacts today." In Afghanistan, a powerful explosion ripped through a prominent Sufi mosque in Kabul Friday in a latest attack on civilians during the month of Ramadan. The blast caused the mosque's roof to cave in on worshippers. The confirmed death toll is 10, but some officials say 50 people may have died in the blast. Some 200,000 Palestinian worshippers gathered at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem to mark Eid. Over the past month, Israeli authorities have repeatedly raided the mosque. At least 42 Palestinians were injured Friday. Meanwhile, Israel's conducted a number of raids in the occupied West Bank after the killing of a guard at an illegal Jewish settlement. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade claimed responsibility for the shooting. Two suspects were arrested. Israeli authorities also fatally shot a young Palestinian man in the back during a raid in the West Bank town of Azun. Millions of protesters took to the streets of cities and towns around the world Sunday to mark May Day, or International Workers' Day. In France, tens of thousands marched through Paris, warning newly reelected President Emmanuel Macron against rolling back workers' rights. Unions say they're prepared to strike if Macron presses ahead with plans to slash unemployment and pension benefits while raising the age of retirement from 62 to 65.
Macron has just been re-elected, but he was re-elected to stop the far right. Yes, but not for his program. And so today I think it is important to show Macron and the rest of the political world that we are ready to protest to defend our social rights, defend what we stand for, defend minorities, minimum wages, retirement age at 60, and many other things.
In Turkey, Police arrested more than 160 people Sunday after protesters ignored a ban on protests in Istanbul's main Taksim Square. In Chile, three people were wounded by gunfire at a May Day rally in the capital Santiago after vigilante street vendors opened fire on the May Day protesters. Elsewhere in Santiago, thousands marched to celebrate a 12.5% increase in the minimum wage approved by the newly elected government of the socialist president Gabriel Boric. In Buenos Aires, thousands of protesters marched to demand a reversal of austerity measures Argentina recently agreed to in exchange for a bailout from the IMF. Here in the United States, hundreds of May Day protesters marched in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in support of immigrant workers. Protesters organized 2 days without Latinxes and immigrants, calling on Republican lawmakers to stop blocking immigration reform and demanding President Biden use his executive powers to protect all immigrants. In Sri Lanka, opposition parties ended a week-long march to the capital, Colombo, on May Day, with thousands of protesters demanding relief from a devastating economic crisis and calling on President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to resign. For months, Sri Lanka's faced dire shortages of food, fuel, and medicine amidst mounting foreign debt and government corruption. On Friday, President Rajapaksa agreed to remove his older brother as prime minister as part of a plan to form an interim government made up of all parties in parliament. The leader of Sri Lanka's main opposition party rejected the plan as insufficient.
The country can't be rescued by making deals with thieves. I would like to tell you all that we have taken a decision not to make any deals with a government of thieves or their partners.
In the state of Georgia, prosecutors in Fulton County are moving ahead with convening a special grand jury to consider whether Donald Trump should be criminally charged for his efforts to pressure Georgia's Secretary of State and other officials to overturn the 2020 election. Jury selection begins today. Meanwhile, in New York, a grand jury looking into Trump's business practices has wrapped up without bringing charges against the former president. The Biden administration has sued the state of Alabama, seeking to block a new law barring gender-affirming medicine for transgender youth while making it a felony to provide such care. In a court filing Friday, the Justice Department argues the ban violates the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees equal protection under the law. It's the first time the administration sued to stop state restrictions on gender-affirming care and comes as Republican-controlled state legislatures are set to break records for the number of new anti-LGBTQ plus bills introduced across the United States. In Florida, three prison guards have been charged with the murder for the beating death of a handcuffed man who is being moved from a prison's mental health unit. Authorities accuse the guards of beating the man even though he was in handcuffs and being compliant. In a statement, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement said, quote, the inmate was beaten so badly he had to be carried to the transport van, unquote. Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle announced the charges.
Misconduct, abuse, or criminal behavior have no place in Florida's correctional system. Individuals who are sentenced to incarceration by our criminal courts, they have lost their freedom, but not their basic rights.
New government data shows the FBI conducted at least 3.4 million searches of private electronic data from Americans last year without a warrant. That's triple the number from the previous year. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence released the data Friday, which showed how many times the FBI submitted queries to a database of emails, texts, and other electronic domestic communications. It's unclear how many individuals were spied on. In New York State, charges have been dismissed against two longtime peace activists who were arrested in 2019 for blocking the entrance to Hancock Air Force Base to protest the U.S. drone war program. Over the last 13 years, about 150 peace activists have been arrested in actions outside the base as part of a campaign organized by the Upstate Drone Action Coalition. The longtime Cuban diplomat, Ricardo Alarcón, has died at the age of 84. He was a student leader during the Cuban Revolution, who eventually became Cuba's foreign minister and president of Cuba's National Assembly. He played a key role in talks between the United States and Cuba for many years. I spoke to him in 2015 after the Cuban embassy reopened in Washington for the first time in 54 years.
The real force that brought about this result was the struggle of the peoples. First of all, the Cuban people, for having resisted for so long time all the odds that that U.S. policy imposed upon us, but also a victory for the rest, the resistance of the rest of the peoples in this hemisphere, including many, many American friends.
Ricardo Alarcón speaking in 2015. He died on May Day, on Sunday. And the longtime prison activist and educator Kathy Boudin has died at the age of 78. Boudin was a former member of the Weather Underground, who was jailed in 1981, along with her then-husband David Gilbert, in connection with an armed car robbery carried out by the Black Liberation Army in Rockland County, New York, that left a security guard and two police officers dead. She served 22 years in prison, where she helped create programs for women who are infected with HIV. She was freed on parole in 2003 and spent the last two decades organizing to fight mass incarceration and to help people, especially women, returning from prison. Kathy Boudin was the co-director and co-founder of the Center for Justice at Columbia University. This is her speaking at New York University School of Law in 2013.
If we could get under the stereotypes and the stigma that are attached to people who have committed violent crimes and be able to see the person underneath it and understand that holding them in prison has nothing to do with them being a public risk, nothing to do with whether they've transformed themselves, and nothing to do with the community that they can serve, if we can get under that and know that they're being kept in only for the purpose of punishment, then maybe we can look at the entire system and be able to change it.
Kathy Boudin speaking in 2013. Her death comes just months after her ex-husband David Gilbert was released from prison in New York. Their son, Chase Boudin, has served as the district attorney of San Francisco since 2020. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, India is facing a devastating heat wave with temperatures reaching 110 degrees in New Delhi. We'll speak with a leading Indian climate change scientist. Stay with us.
Hoy es el tiempo de puede ser mañana. Justicia e igualdad. Sopla como el viento la flor de la quebrada, limpio como el fuego el cañón de mi fusil. Levántate y mírate las manos.
That's Judy Collins performing Victor Jara's Prayer to a Laborer. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in India, where temperatures have soared to the highest level since recording began more than 120 years ago. Residents of India's capital, New Delhi, faced 100-degree temperatures in the capital, Delhi, Thursday and Friday.
The summer that arrived in May and June last year has arrived now in April, in the 1st of May. It is extremely hot.
The situation is very bad. It is extremely hot and power cuts are troubling us a lot. There is no electricity for the entire day. The power cuts are more so. To get relief from the heat, we have to come here.
Again, temperatures reached 110 degrees over and over again. This comes as Delhi reportedly saw its second hottest April in 72 years, with an average high temperature of 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, cities in neighboring Pakistan recorded scorching temperatures of over 116 degrees Fahrenheit Friday. The heat wave in the region has led to power cuts, triggered health warnings, prompted officials to close schools in at least two Indian states, and caused widespread crop damage, including in the Indian state of Punjab, known as the country's breadbasket. Scientists link the early onset of the region's intense summer to climate change and say more than a billion people may be impacted by more frequent and longer heat waves. For more, we go to Bangalore, India, where we're joined by Chandni Singh, senior researcher on climate change adaptation at the Indian Institute for Human Settlements. She's lead author at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. She was also a lead author on the Asia chapter in the most recent IPCC report and draft author on the report's summary for policymakers. In a Twitter thread about the heat wave, she noted, quote, "It is deep climate injustice that those who face the brunt of the current heat wave have contributed so little to the problem." Chandni Singh, welcome to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us. Explain the extent of the crisis in India right now.
Thank you so much for having me. I think as you laid it out very clearly right now, there is a very severe heat wave going on, not only in India, but in Pakistan as well, hitting temperatures of anything from 110 to 116 degrees Fahrenheit, which is absolutely debilitating if you go out in the sun. What is most problematic is that while some people have the opportunity to stay indoors and cool their homes, there are lots of livelihoods that necessitate you to go outdoors. People working as construction laborers, as agricultural laborers or street vendors, for example, have to go out. And they are, of course, seeing the brunt of this heat wave.
Can you talk about its relationship with the climate catastrophe? Can you respond to people who just say, that's weather?
Yes. So there has been a lot of back and forth on this, that how, to what extent can we attribute these current heat waves to anthropogenic climate change? What we know clearly is from the climate science that we are expected to and already seeing longer and more intense heat waves that are more frequent across the Indian subcontinent because of anthropogenic climate change. So that is already very clear. However, specific events, it's more difficult to attribute them. And that's really, I think, a lot of scientists are working on that currently to say whether this heat wave is attributable to climate change. I'd also like to add that the World Meteorological Organization, the WMO, put out a statement the other day that it's too early to attribute this particular set of heat waves to climate change, which was picked up by a lot of media outlets. But the second line in their statement really reads that, this particular heat wave is as expected because of anthropogenic climate change. So it is a trend that we're seeing. We don't know, we can't say with a lot of certainty on this particular event right now.
And can you talk about how the heat is threatening India's wheat harvest, which is devastating not only for people in India, but also potentially for other countries seeking alternatives because Russia and Ukraine, which provides 30% of the world's wheat exports, because of the war, that's completely interrupted that.
Absolutely. So wheat in India, of course, is a winter crop. And so because wheat requires cold temperatures, both for tillering, so for the wheat yield to be good and for the seed to form in a certain size of seed. Wheat is then harvested in March and April in India and across North India, which is, as you said, the breadbasket of the country. And what we've seen is that particularly wheat that was supposed to be harvested in April, which is the late wheat, has seen a reduction in yields. And this, of course, has direct implications on food security for farm households as well as farm incomes. And many of our farmers are, as it is, struggling with the range of issues like water scarcity and poor soil. And then on top of that, this heat wave really adds to that, risk. So we've been talking a lot about compounding risk in the IPCC, which is that you've got a heat wave, but surrounding it, you've got water scarcity and also the pandemic. Let's not forget that. So multiple things coming together to really exacerbate risk for certain people.
You talk about compounding risk and cascading risk. Explain.
Yes. So this idea of compounding risk is, as I said, multiple things happening simultaneously. Last year, we actually saw a cyclone on the east coast of India happening while we had the pandemic raging, the second wave of the pandemic. So you've got multiple things coming together, which can really test your health infrastructure, the kinds of, you know, just the our government systems that are expected to deal with all kinds of disasters. So that's the idea of compounding risk. On the other side, you have this idea of cascading risk, which is that what happens in one sector won't stay in the same sector. A classical example of that is agriculture and food yields in rural areas then cascading out to cities. So you've got things that are moving from sector to sector, which, of course, can also have a lot of ripple effects throughout the country, but even beyond the country based on trade routes.
And then talk about this issue that you tweeted about and you speak so much about, which is the issue of climate injustice. You said in a Twitter thread, it's deep hashtag climate injustice that those who face the brunt of the current heat wave have contributed so little to the problem.
Yes. So this really came out of, I have grown up in Delhi and I have throughout my life learned to live with heat. I think a lot of Indians will say that we have our own coping strategies to deal with extreme heat. This time, for a range of reasons, I was out at around 2 p.m. walking and trying to get a bus. And then when I came back home, that long bus ride was quite excruciating, but I knew that I was going back to a home where I had electricity, where I could cool my home. I had an air conditioner, lots of cool water that was also clean. And so there was that to look forward to and know that I can recuperate from this heat exposure. And then thinking about as I was going in the bus, there were many passengers with me, many of them who I knew would be getting off at these very low income settlements that people who don't have, first of all, the resources to buy air conditioners or coolers of any kind, and then also the money to pay electricity bills that are needed to run these things. And so there's this. That's what I call a deep injustice, which is that, first of all, there is differential capacity to manage heat. But the second deeper injustice is that a lot of these people, their carbon footprints are extremely low. And so if we think about the problem of climate change, it's really not driven by low-income settlements and poor people across the developing world, across the global south. And so this is something that in my own work on climate justice and vulnerability I've been talking about, which is that historical emitters of greenhouse gases have to step up because we are in countries like India and Pakistan really hitting the limits of adapting to heat. There is a certain limit beyond which humans cannot survive this kind of heat. So it's a deep injustice in that sense.
You've also said that while India's elected leaders have a critical role to play, you can't adapt your way out of this heat. Framing it as India's imperative alone masks the role high emitters have played in bringing us here. We've got to mitigate, and India can't do it alone. At the same time, you have UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres criticizing how fossil fuel companies are responding to the war in Ukraine. He said also in a tweet, fossil fuel interests are now cynically using the war in Ukraine to try to lock in a high carbon future. A shift to renewables is crucial to mending our broken global energy mix and offering hope to millions suffering climate impacts today. Can you talk about how these two issues come together?
Absolutely. So one of the critical things that a lot of climate change researchers and also civil society organizations are thinking about now in the run-up to the COP27, which is the Conference of Parties going to happen in November this year in Egypt, where there'll be a lot of climate negotiations at an international level. There's a lot of concern that finances that would have moved towards climate adaptation and mitigation might end up going towards, first of all, COVID recovery, and then second of all, just managing and dealing with the outcomes of this terrible war. So there is a sense of worry around that. And we know from all the work that various climate researchers are doing across the world that there is a sense of urgency. We don't have the luxury really of doing things incrementally. So first dealing with a war, then perhaps a pandemic, and then climate action. So there's this concern around finances getting diluted and the urgency going away from climate mitigation in particular. So I think there's and that's what I say really about India's stance. I mean, many journalists go on asking me about what should Prime Minister Modi do. There is a lot India is already doing, I think, on mitigation and adaptation. Of course, there's a long way for all countries to go ahead. But really, it comes down to how much each country can do based on their where they are in their development trajectory and the number of poor people they have to pull out of poverty and vulnerability. So it's not India's responsibility alone, while India, of course, has a lot to do.
Chandni Singh, we want to thank you for being with us, senior researcher on climate change adaptation at the Indian Institute for Human Settlements, and one of the lead authors of the IPCC report on the Asia chapter. We thank you for joining us as we turn now to continue to look at climate change, but at how a devastating new report finds that one in five reptiles are threatened by extinction, with turtles and half of all crocodile species most at risk. That's the conclusion of the first comprehensive study of over 10,000 reptile species around the world that took nearly 1,000 scientists and 15 years to complete. The study was just published in the journal Nature, found multiple factors are threatening reptiles, including deforestation, urban encroachment, hunting, and the climate emergency. This is environmental biologist Leslie Risler with the National Science Foundation.
Species are declining at a rapid rate. Some estimates 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times more than the background rate of extinction that normally happens on the planet. So we're at a really critical time in our, in Earth's history.
For more, we're joined in San Jose, Costa Rica, by Bruce Young, co-leader of the new study assessing the global extinction risk of reptiles, chief zoologist and senior conservation scientist for NatureServe. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Dr. Young. If you can start off by talking about what surprised you most about the results of this study.
Well, thank you for having me. So you've described the major results. It was a long time in coming, as you described. For me, I was expecting reptiles would be somehow different than many of the other groups that we'd already studied. I mean, the history here, or the context, is that we'd finished assessing the world's birds in the 1990s. I participated in completing the global amphibian assessment in 2003. The mammals were done by 2008, and we just took a long time getting the reptiles done for a variety of reasons. And the whole time we were sort of nervous that with all this information on birds, mammals, and amphibians that was driving lots of priority setting in the conservation world, that reptiles were being left out. That we know that reptiles are unusually diverse in desert areas compared to other species. And we just worried that they were really falling through the conservation cracks. So what surprised me of our results is when we looked at the proportions of species that were subject to the different threats, they're actually the exact same threats almost as birds, mammals, and amphibians. And so there's nothing new about what we need to do to protect reptiles. The other surprising finding we found is around this term called surrogacy. It's something that conservation planners use because we don't have information on all species. There's millions of species out there. We use the species we do have information about to set our priorities for conservation. And we hope that the species that we're working on are good surrogates for these other species. And what we found was that birds, mammals, and amphibians actually serve as good conservation surrogates for threatened reptiles. So that means if you do your prioritization based on those three groups, which we've had information for more than a decade, you're actually going to take care of a lot of the diversity of threatened reptiles. So that's kind of good news in a sense, that there isn't this whole new category of conservation that we need to address today.
So if nothing is done to conserve reptiles, can you talk about overall what's happening to global ecosystems? How much time do we have to try to mend the loss of over 20% of reptiles on Earth?
Yeah, like I said, the fate of reptiles is wrapped up with the fate of many other species. I mean, I can't give any numbers in terms of, you know, how many years we have. What we found is that reptiles are actually the most diverse numerically in tropical rainforests. Again, that should sound familiar. We know that birds, mammals, and amphibians are also very diverse in tropical rainforests. So when you hear about continued deforestation in the Amazon, for example, that means we're losing reptile species there, just like we're losing other species. And it's causing that problem with climate change due to the loss of all that stored carbon in the forest there.
You talk about multiple factors, deforestation, urban encroachment, hunting, the climate emergency. You're in Costa Rica, in Central America, which has historically been the site, the whole region, for extractive projects like mines and hydroelectric dams. How have these industries, largely funded by multinationals, affected or contributed to the crisis?
Here in Costa Rica, it's a bit different than elsewhere. We don't have many minerals here. And in fact, it goes back to the whole history of Costa Rica. There was never gold found here. So it was a very different kind of people that settled, Europeans that settled Costa Rica compared to the other countries. We do have a tremendous amount of hydropower. From a climate perspective, that's a good thing. In Costa Rica, 99% of our electricity is generated from renewables, principally hydropower. These are financed through international financing mechanisms and carried out by the Costa Rican Electricity Corporation, which is a nationalized firm. Projects do have a negative effect on the environment, no doubt about it. River systems are changed, flows and all that kind of thing are heavily impacted. For reptiles, it's not a big thing because there are almost no reptiles that inhabit these rivers that come off of the mountains. There's crocodiles in that where these rivers come out to the ocean, but they're not affected by those dams. So in fact, I mean, reptiles are relatively unaffected compared to many invertebrates, otters, and things like that that live in the rivers themselves.
As we wrap up, Dr. Young, can you talk about the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, what makes it so important? The UN Biodiversity Conference is coming up in Kunming, China in October.
Well, our study reminds us of what's riding on this convention. You know, we just described 1,800 species of reptiles that are threatened with extinction. That's a small part of the 40,000 species that the IUCN Red List lists as endangered with extinction across the globe. That's a tremendous part of our biodiversity, our natural heritage, is riding on the success of those negotiations. So this is a big moment. For the last 10 years, we were under the Aichi targets that were set in the year 2010 under the Convention on Biological Diversity. They expired in 2020. And since then, there's been the negotiation for what the so-called post-2020 framework. What we learned from the Aichi target experience is that even though governments set those targets, there wasn't much kind of implementation of conservation measures. And in fact, when we looked at it, almost none of those targets were reached. So this time for this post-2020 framework. We're hoping for real targets with real mechanisms that hold countries accountable for achieving those targets. So as I say, there's a lot riding on these discussions and negotiations that are due to come to a head at COP15 in Kunming.
Bruce Young, we want to thank you for being with us, co-leader of the new study assessing the global extinction risk of reptiles, chief zoologist and senior conservation scientist for NatureServe, speaking to us from Costa Rica. Next up, we get an update on Ukraine from Jan Egeland, the secretary general of the Norwegian Refugee Council, just back from Ukraine. Stay with us.
Porcelain, are you wasting away in your skin? Are you missing the love of your kin? Drifting and floating and fading away. Porcelain, do you smell like a girl when you smile? Can you bear not to share with your child? Drifting and floating and fading away. Little loom, all day. Little loom.
Porcelain by Red Hot Chili Peppers. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Ukraine. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi became the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Ukraine over the weekend, days after President Biden asked Congress for an additional $33 billion in aid for Ukraine. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian government says about 100 civilians have been able to evacuate the besieged Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol after the United Nations helped establish what it described as a safe passage operation. But this comes as hundreds more civilians and many fighters remain trapped at the plant and elsewhere in Mariupol. Shelling is continuing today. For more on the humanitarian crisis facing Ukrainians, we're joined by Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He was just in Lviv, Kyiv, Ternopil, as well as Bucha, where he visited the site of a mass grave of murdered civilians. Jan Egeland, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what you found this time? You were only recently in Ukraine, and then you returned. Why don't you start in Bucha?
Bucha is totally devastated. It was a beautiful little town just north of Kyiv. I was there. I was in Irpin. I was born in Dianka. These were suburban towns where there were a lot of gardens, a lot of parks, beautiful places. Now they are devastated beyond belief. For me, it's like Syria, where again there are entire towns that now look like Stalingrad and Dresden looked in 1945. This war is raging in a way we haven't seen in a long time. It's urban warfare, and it's devastating the lives of millions of people.
So, did you actually see a mass grave in Bucha?
Well, we were where on the very place. It's just outside of a church where they found the largest mass grave in Bucha. Those bodies had, thankfully, now been excavated and have been placed elsewhere. They have also been, subject to a forensic investigation so that there can be evidence for potential war crimes trials in the future. Bucha is the place where perhaps they found the most bodies in places like where I visited, but also the other towns have had a lot of loss of civilian human lives.
And as we speak in Mariupol, you have perhaps 100 people have been able to get out of the Azovstal steel plant, making their way to Zaporizhia. But there are many hundreds more, both civilians, wounded fighters, both in the plant and outside of that. Reports are that 90% of Mariupol is destroyed. You're the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Can you talk about the crisis there and the other places that you went to?
Well, Mariupol has been now besieged for nearly 2 months. Besiegement means basically that you encircle a place and you do not allow anything to get in terms of supplies to the people who are starving inside, and you do not let the civilians or others escape from the besieged place, which means suffering again beyond belief. There were children in these basements for very many weeks. They didn't see daylight. They were awake all nights, night after night, because of the constant shelling. What I fear is that this will happen now with many more towns, cities in the east and in the south of Ukraine, where the battle is now raging. In Bucha, Irpin, Borodyanka, where I visited and where the Norwegian Refugee Council is starting relief work, the Russian forces have withdrawn. They have intensified their attacks in the east and the south, which again means that militarily cities will be encircled. And when they are encircled, there may well be besiegement, which again means that a place like Severodonetsk, where NRC had our headquarters in the east before the invasion, that place, which is now 80-85% destroyed, Mariupol may be 90% destroyed. So it's again a destroyed city, but not yet under besiegement. That place may also be under besiegement. I don't think the world has understood enough that this suffering will become even deeper, especially in the east and the south, if the war is allowed to rage on like now.
You've said that hundreds of thousands of older adults, of senior citizens, are trapped in Ukraine's east. Younger people are more able to move, but many people in their 70s and 80s and beyond, some of whom have disabilities, can't move. Describe what is being done.
That is the very nature of the east, where the battle is now raging with an enormous intensity. I visited the east just before the invasion at the beginning of February, and I was really struck by a war zone where, not as it is normally would be, from Afghanistan to Somalia to Congo to across the Middle East, Africa and elsewhere, the majority are children. These are young populations, 50%, 60% children. In the east where I was, there were areas where 60% was 60 years and older. A lot of them miners, retired miners, the widows of retired miners. The younger population had already left and gone west because of the downturn of mining and industrial work. Now, a lot of the families who remain with children have fled, but the elder people, they stay behind. I asked several of these elderly women, for example, that I met in small villages along the then front line, why aren't you leaving? And they answered with one voice, really, we cannot leave. Where should we go? One woman described how she had two sons, one in Moscow, one in Kiev. Where would I go? This is my home. I will stay no matter what. And the media is not able to cover what happens there because it's in the middle of the crossfire. But the elderly people are still there.
President Biden has asked the U.S. Congress to give $33 billion more dollars. It will overwhelmingly go to military weapons, presumably, some humanitarian aid. Can you talk about how you see this war ending, the polarization on the U.N. Security Council? What needs to be done now, Jan Egeland?
Well, it's not going to end by through an arms race on either side. It's going to end with talks at the negotiating table where minority issues and Ukrainians' relations to foreign military alliances and so on can be discussed. And to enable those discussions, it will end by a ceasefire where the Russians that are attacking agree to a generalized ceasefire that could also enable our humanitarian work to reach all people and civilians to be able to, that those who want to leave, that they can leave. Then the diplomats should sit down and agree on the bargaining table the future of the two neighbors, Ukraine and Russia. It's not going to end with an arms race between the West and Ukraine on the one side and Russia on the other.
And your thoughts on your neighbors, Sweden and Finland, possibly joining NATO?
Well, they are going to decide, both countries, very soon whether they want to join NATO. Norway has been a member since the initiation of NATO. It's of course paradoxical how the invasion of Ukraine has really bolstered the Europe in its opposition to this. Where humanitarians, where neutral, impartial, independent. We are in a race against the clock to reach the people in the south and in the north and in the east, especially, of Ukraine. At the moment, we need more resources to win that race against the clock, but we also need agreements. Humanitarian pauses are much better than humanitarian corridors, which are too fragile agreements to really be workable. Generalized humanitarian ceasefires is the best. We need it desperately.
And can you talk about the diversion of the crisis of humanitarian funding needed in other places, whether we're talking about Burma, Yemen, Palestine, South Sudan? How are these being affected by the amount of money and the fighting in Ukraine?
They are really affected more negatively than the world has understood in three ways. First, because all attention and a lot of the resources are now going to this tremendous war in the middle of Europe. 13 million people now have been displaced. It is sucking up all attention and all resources. Secondly, this is a war in the grain chamber of the world. Ukraine and Russia, these areas have really furnished African countries, Middle Eastern countries, with the majority of their grain. The prices are going through the roof now, so the Somalis have to be in a bidding war for the remaining grain in the world with rich countries like Norway or the United States. Thirdly, this war has made another Cold War between Russia and to some extent China and the West, which means that, you know, how can we get agreements on Syria and Yemen and so on in the Security Council, where there's now going to be a stalemate and no cooperation between the great powers? It's very, very worrying, far beyond Ukraine.
5.5 million Ukrainians have left the country. Millions have moved within the country. What is the most critical need right now?
The most critical need now is to get enough resources to those who are closest to the battle. NRC, we were able, just as I visited a few days back, to get out 6,600 boxes with food to bomb shelter, to collective centers in Luhansk and Donetsk. I fear some of those people will be unreachable next week because of the battle. Secondly, we need to, in addition to get the pure, emergency relief to the front lines, We need to get cash in hand to Ukrainians who are fleeing and who have no have exhausted all of their resources. We're also making progress there with funding from the United States and many other countries. We're now able to transfer small amounts of money each month to families that have lost everything. Often these are mothers and children fleeing, whether in central or western Ukraine or in Poland and other neighboring countries.
Jan Egeland, I want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, as we end today's show with the words of the longtime Cuban diplomat Ricardo Alarcón, who died on May Day at the age of 84 in Cuba. He was a student leader during the Cuban Revolution, who eventually became Cuba's foreign minister and president of the National Assembly, Cuba's parliament, played a key role in talks between the U.S. and Cuba for many years. I spoke to him in 2015 outside the Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C., which had been opened for the first time in more than half a century.
We have to say that it was and it is the result of many years of struggle by many people. The Cuban people, but many friends here in this country and around the globe. And I think it's a victory. It has to be recognized as a victory for us, for our people, and for all those who were opposing the U.S. policies during this half a century. At the same time, it should be recognized the merit of President Obama for having realized that it was high time to abandon a policy that he himself recognized as a failure. It's still, we have come a long way, but there is still a long way to go ahead of us. But for the first time, it will be the Americans and Cubans dealing with each other on an equal footing. Something very important, Amy, that I think that everybody should remember. Last Saturday, the United States was the only country in the Western Hemisphere who didn't have an embassy in Havana. And Cuba was the only country in the Western Hemisphere without an embassy here. Now, what has happened is that the U.S. has joined the rest of Latin America and the Caribbean. This story began when the U.S. succeeded in isolating Cuba from the rest of the hemisphere. And now, the first chapter has ended with the U.S. ending its isolation from the rest of the continent.
How did it happen?
You should not overstate the role of diplomats, the professionals, the real force that brought about this result was the struggle of the peoples. First of all, the Cuban people, for having resisted for so long time all the odds that U.S. policy imposed upon us, but also a victory for the rest, the resistance of the rest of the peoples in this hemisphere, including many, many American friends.
You have been a diplomat for decades.
Yeah.
Cuba was just taken off the list of terrorist nations in the United States. How does that feel, not to be considered a terrorist anymore?
Frankly speaking, if you had asked Nelson Mandela how did he feel about being in that list, Mandela was considered a terrorist probably for a longer period of time. His entire life, when he was in prison, when he got out of prison, when he was elected president of South Africa, when he got the Nobel Peace Prize, he was on the list of the State Department list of terrorists. And they took him out in 2008, I suspect, because they were suspecting Mandela was going to die, and was going to die in that infamous list. By the way, it was a senator from Massachusetts, now Secretary of State, who said at that time that it was a shame on the U.S. policy to have that list, and in that list, people like Mandela. In the list or not being in the list, it doesn't matter. The embargo is a matter of other laws. other different laws that has to be removed.
Longtime Cuban diplomat Ricardo Alarcón has died at the age of 84. He was speaking on Democracy Now! In 2015 in Washington, D.C., after the Cuban embassy was reopened there for the first time in 54 years. The Trump administration put Cuba back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism in 2021. Biden has not reversed President Trump's reversing Obama's normalization process for Cuba. To see the whole interview, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
RCT in sound from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine a recent federal ruling that says that more likely than not, Donald Trump, former president, has committed federal crimes.
We are joined today by Professor Michael Tiger, an expert in these issues, to help us sort this out. Stay tuned.
Today we also get an expert's analysis of the way in which the mainstream media is reporting on the war.
No one is more adept than our guest Norman Solomon in unpacking the lies of the major media.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. There is a great deal of speculation as to whether former President Donald Trump will eventually be indicted for crimes allegedly committed while he was the president. Well, in what might prove to be the most serious blow yet to Trump's efforts to stay out of jail, on March 28th, a federal judge ruled that both former President Trump and attorney John Eastman, who had advised him on how to overturn the 2020 election, had most likely committed felonies, including obstructing the work of Congress and conspiring to defraud the United States. The ruling represents a highly significant breakthrough for the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Judge David O. Carter found that the actions taken by Trump and Eastman amounted to, and I quote, a coup in search of a legal theory, close quote. The judge's ruling may be the House committee's biggest win to date, as it suggests that the investigators have already built a case strong enough to convince a federal judge of Trump's culpability in the January 6th insurrection. Specifically, the ruling means that the House committee will now receive more than 100 emails related to the legal strategy proposed by Eastman to pressure Vice President Mike Pence not to certify electors from swing states when Congress convened on January 6th, and thus to not certify the electoral vote. In making his ruling, Judge Carter said, and again I quote, Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history. Well, just how significant is this federal court ruling?
What would a federal prosecutor need to show a judge and jury to be able to hold Trump liable for his actions around January 6th? And what about other actions by the former president while in office that many criminal law experts claim were also illegal? And of course, what role will politics ultimately play in determining whether Trump ever stands trial and is convicted by a jury? Now, to help us sort all of this out, we are indeed fortunate today to have as our guest, attorney and professor Michael Tiger. Professor Tiger has been acting professor of law at UCLA, the Joseph D. Jamels Chair of Law at the University of Texas, and the holder of an endowed professorship at Washington College of Law. He is the author of numerous books, including Thinking About Terrorism, The Threat to Civil Liberties in Times of National Emergency. And he has represented such notable clients as the Washington Post, Representative Ron Dellums, and activist attorney Lynn Stewart. Professor Michael Tiger, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
As the House of Representatives Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol continues to, well, amass evidence against those involved in the attempted insurrection, U.S. District Judge David Carter issued an extraordinary